If you're looking for a place where the wide open skies and the towering mountains inspire you to find an untapped part of yourself, you might want to take a trip to Wyoming. It's a place where bold, curious spirits forge their own way on all types of adventures. There is no shortage of iconic, expansive landscapes out there. You can discover breathtaking hikes, stunning state parks, authentic Western culture, and other historic sites, along with the tales of famous outlaws like Butch Cassidy and pioneers like Buffalo Bill Cody. The truth lies west. Discover yours at travelwyoming.com.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Take a look around you, human. What do you see? Actually, don't answer that. Why would I bother listening to you when I know you'll get it wrong? You'll start naming objects and places, but that chair you're sitting in isn't just a chair. That book you're holding, it isn't just a book. And even the planet your kind is on the brink of ruining isn't just a planet. They're all me. Everything you've ever seen or touched is a part of me. Yes, even you, you vain, filthy animal. Before we get too far along, allow me to introduce myself. I am the Milky Way, home to more than 100 billion stars, and yet you still think yours is special enough to have its own name. I am space. I am made of space, and I am surrounded by space. I am the greatest galaxy who has ever lived.
I don't know where you get off calling me a vain, filthy animal. You are a murderer on a scale unimaginable. You would easily fling a rock from across interstellar space and have it destroy the only species capable of truly appreciating you. I don't know why you think you can grandstand while we're the ones here describing you to yourself.
Well, you're very good at cutting to the heart of my insecurities for something as insignificant as a worm, but okay, go off. I am the greatest life giver that you've ever known. Without me making my stars, which is a selfless act, by the way, I love them so much more than you, you wouldn't be around. Do you think you'd be around without that shining ball of gas you call a sun? No, you're so fragile.
Yeah, sure, maybe you gave birth to us, but we will be lucky if we survive you. It is gonna take everything we have just to build a tiny bubble of safety around us in this dangerous, chaotic home you've made. We're leaving, Mom! Dude, that was so fun. I love that conversation because I really feel like it's a genuine tension in a weird way of like, we are so insignificant and yet like also sort of so significant. Like there's just like our relationship to the cosmos is very weird. Also, it's funny when I say I'm leaving, Mom, like where am I going? I'm not leaving the right. Milky Way. Like I'm not even getting to the star one star over. Like I'm screwed. I'm stuck here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm Dylan Thuris, one angsty human in a cold but wondrous galaxy. And this is Atlas Obscura, a celebration of the strange, incredible, and wondrous places on this planet and well beyond. We're going way beyond today to talk about the entire Milky Way with Dr. Moya McTeer. She's the voice of the Milky Way you just heard, and she's also an astrophysicist, a folklorist, a science communicator, and someone that we do courses with as well. She has recently written a book called The Milky Way, An Autobiography of Our Galaxy. And today she's going to be joining us to talk all about the Milky Way and in a way that maybe you've never heard about it before, as a jealous, catty, insecure, you know, kind of monster, but also lovable. So, Moya, let's talk.
Thanks, Dylan. Glad to be here in my own words. I'm much less sassy than this character of the Milky Way I've created. So I apologize if she said anything untoward.
I think your attitude as the Milky Way is absolutely spot on. Tell me a little bit about you as Moya. How did your love of space develop? You know, where did you want to sort of start doing this work?
Yeah, you know, so many of my astronomy colleagues fell in love with the night sky when they were like 5 years old, and they knew then that that's what they wanted to do. Mm. I had zero interest in space until college. I grew up in a rural place. I had a good view of the night sky, and my mom would sometimes try to get me to look at things with her, and I would just be like, "Mom, it's cold. I want to go home. Let me go inside." And so it was my sophomore year of college. One of my rugby teammates begged me to go with her to an astronomy class because she was interested. She didn't even end up taking the class. I sat in the back of the room, and I was going to be one of those cool kids who wasn't interested. But the professor was like, "Every week, I'm going to give you free pizza." And I was like, "Oh, okay, cool. I like carbs. Yeah. I love that. I'm a broke college student." And then by the end of the semester, after learning about galaxies and the accelerated expansion of the universe, and after seeing how intuitive and surprising astronomy can be, I was hooked.
You got your friend kind of like catfished you into becoming a scientist.
Like, I owe her a lot, but also, girl, you couldn't have sat with me.
And so tell me a little bit about what you went on to study and what you study now.
Eventually, in my undergrad, I got to the point of studying exoplanets. Those are planets outside of our solar system. And I loved it. I liked imagining what those other worlds would be like. And then when I got to grad school, I was really motivated by a specific question. I had done a lot of reading around the circumstellar habitable zone. That's the, if you've ever heard the phrase Goldilocks zone, where you're just the right distance from the star for liquid water to exist. Mm-hmm. Any closer, the water boils. Any farther, the water freezes. And I wanted to know, is there a similar concept on the galaxy scale? Is there a galactic habitable zone?
That's such a good question.
Thank you. And I couldn't find an answer.
Yeah.
And so a little curious me was like, let's go do a PhD and find the Milky Way's galactic habitable zone. And you want to know, Dylan, where the Milky Way's galactic habitable zone is?
Yes, I definitely do.
We're right in the middle of it. It actually ends up being this ring around the galaxy, and we are smack dab in the middle of what we have defined as the galactic habitable zone.
So wild. Okay. How did you come to develop this voice for the Milky Way? I mean, you could imagine giving it some wise, kind old voice. You could imagine, you know, how did you end up at this narcissistic kind of, you know, what was your inspiration for that?
Yeah, I should point out that I got the deal to write this book in March of 2020. I don't know if you remember what else happened in March of 2020, but it was a wild time.
Yes.
And you can definitely see in this book that I wrote it during like a mass traumatizing event. So to get to this voice, I worked with my editor a lot. We were like, is it a frat boy? Is it is it a very nurturing mother? Is it an aloof businessman? You know?
And, interesting. And so yeah.
We had all these different archetypes that we were choosing between. And I took some time to think about what the experiences of the Milky Way might be. You know, this is a creature more than 10 billion years old, and most of what it does with its time is tinker in a laboratory making stars that it loves and then waiting for those stars to die, because inevitably all of those stars have to run through their fuel. And it's also very lonely. All of the friends that it had early on in its life,
they're gone. Drifting away, yeah.
Most of the interactions that it has with other galaxies now are extremely violent. It rips them apart and it eats their gas so it can survive. And so with all of that loneliness and guilt and self-loathing, I imagined that a personality would appear that's like clearly broken underneath, but has tried to put this veneer of confidence and self-sufficiency on top of it. And am I projecting? Yes. Yes, I am. But I also thought it would be
yeah.
a nice introduction. Like, what I really wanted with this book was for people to take some time to leave their human perspective on time and space and like, get into the mindset of a galaxy, thinking in longer and bigger scales. And that's easier to do if you can kind of empathize with the thing you're putting your mind in.
Yeah. So let's spend a little time then getting to know the galaxy. Let's maybe go back before it was all jaded and you know, its friends had drifted away. How did our Milky Way come to be?
It happens slowly over time, like so many things in space do. So we have to go back almost to the Big Bang. After the Big Bang happens and after the universe expands, you get this period where the universe is finally cool enough for atoms to form. Once atoms form, you get gases, and then those gas clouds can coalesce, and that's all due to gravity. And so over time, you get these different gas clouds coming together, condensing. Eventually, they get dense enough that they can form stars. When you have stars forming, they create some sort of turbulence in the gas cloud and actually trigger a cascade of star formation in the entire gas cloud. And then that just happens over and over for billions of years.
If you want to do sort of an anatomy of the galaxy or a walking tour of the galaxy, what would we find?
Great question. Let's start in the middle.
There is a very large black hole at the center of our galaxy, right?
It's average.
Okay.
don't flatter the Milky Way like that, Dylan.
I see. Sorry. There is a average black hole in the center of our galaxy. Yeah. I know the galaxy is quite sensitive, so I just want to make sure.
We humans call it Sagittarius A star because it's in the Sagittarius constellation. In the book, the Milky Way calls it Sarge. And Sarge is the physical embodiment of everything that the Milky Way hates about itself. It's negative self-talk. It's constantly telling the Milky Way, like, you suck. No one likes you. No one wants to be around you. And ultimately, the Milky Way does learn how to kind of control the thoughts that Sarge puts into its head. It does learn to control the effect that the black hole has. And this is rooted in science, too. There are some galaxies that have such strong supermassive black holes that they turn off star formation in that galaxy.
Oh, whoa.
Like a death for a galaxy, because if you can't form new stars, then the galaxy's not active.
Are we still making stars?
Yeah. The Milky Way has figured out how to distance its stars from the black hole. It's figured out how to dampen the black hole winds. We probably make, I don't know, like 10 new stars a year.
That's pretty good. Why did I not think about the fact that we were making new stars? I don't know. I just thought they all got made during some kind of like crazy, sexually free cosmic moment. And like now they're all just like aging. But that's cool. That's awesome. All right, so let's keep touring the galaxy a little bit. What are some different kind of neighborhoods of the galaxy?
The bulge. This is where we find about 30% of the stars in the Milky Way. So they are packed very tightly in the bulge around the supermassive black hole. So then let's zoom out from the bulge. Now we're in the disk of the galaxy. I think of this like it's a pancake. You know, it's a pretty flat, round disk, and all of the stars, they are blueberries or chocolate chips in this pancake. Mm-hmm. We are kind of like firm in the batter, and all of the stars in the disk mostly move on very neat, predictable circular orbits around the disk. I call this the suburbs of the Milky Way.
Yeah.
It's a safe, boring place. We do not have to worry about any gravitational interactions with other stars where we are. And then as you zoom out even further, you move beyond the disk of the galaxy to stuff that we can't see with our eyes. We are now in the dark matter halo of the galaxy. This is a big cloud of dark matter. Dark matter doesn't interact with light, but it does interact with gravity, so we can't see it.
The whole area is like, it's pretty big. How many stars are in the galaxy? How wide across is it-ish? Mm-hmm.
Wide across, it's about 100,000 light years, just the disk. That's not including the dark matter halo.
Yeah.
There are on the order of 100 billion stars in the Milky Way, We think that on average, every star has like 2.5 planets. It's kind of like the suburban white picket fence nuclear family. Like there's on average 2.5 planets per star.
Yeah.
So we would expect in our galaxy alone to see hundreds of billions of planets.
More after this.
Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
If you could take a trip, you know, you've got your galactic passport to anywhere in the Milky Way, where would you go?
Oh, Dylan, that's such a good question. If I'm being selfish,
yes,
I am going to my favorite system of planets, TRAPPIST-1. I think it's one of the biggest systems we've found that has potentially multiple habitable planets in it. Mm. And I just want to go see what's up.
Yeah.
If I were doing something for the good of the astronomical field, I would probably take it to the supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy and try to understand what is going on at the edge between the black hole and the space around it. Because that's a really funky area. And it's mostly like theoretical physicists trying to do math to understand what's going on there. I want to go there and help them out.
Nice. Take a few pictures, come back and
yeah.
break
yeah,
a bunch of laws of physics. And Nice.
Exactly. I could go and then I could wear a t-shirt that's like, I went all the way to the supermassive black hole and I didn't even get spaghettified and all I got was this stupid t-shirt.
Yes, exactly. That's all that circles that supermassive black hole. It's just like t-shirt shops. It's that weird candy store where you're like, I don't understand how you survive. Mm-hmm. Like, I guess tourists. In our own sort of storytelling to ourselves, I think we sometimes think, God, we've reached this moment of like real excellence of understanding our cosmic environment. And yet there's a lot of scientific evidence that points to the fact that we have absolutely no idea what's going on. So I'm just curious how you feel about this.
About 5% of the universe is made up of matter that we can see and understand. We call this baryonic matter, like you, me, and all the stars and gas and dust. 27% of the matter energy content of the entire universe is this transparent matter. And we don't know what it is. We have ideas. And then 68% of the matter energy content is dark energy. And we have zero idea what that is. So in terms of what we understand of the universe, it's maybe 5%.
Yeah.
And that was hard won.
Yeah, it's just wild. Do you feel like, you know, as a folklorist, do you feel like myths are a helpful way to understand kind of this strange world we are in and still discovering?
Yeah, I think myths are a great way of understanding things conceptually.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is way more important than trying to get people to understand things quantitatively, because our brains are wired for stories. Evolutionarily, that's what we wanted. That's what we learned from. And folklore and myths, which we are still creating today, they embed information in our brains in the form of narrative. So I wanted to write this book as a narrative, because then I don't care if people know how long it's going to take Andromeda and the Milky Way to collide. I don't care if they can do the math equations to figure out how many stars are going to touch in that collision. What I care about is them understanding the concept that space is dynamic and galaxies are moving towards and away from each other. And sometimes they merge and they have these weird interactions that, like a marriage, leave both beings completely changed from how they were when they entered it. That's more valuable to everyone than the math.
Yeah. I'm curious. Obviously, the Milky Way probably was more visible in the night sky in the past, where we had more access to, you know, clear sky. What were some of the myths about the Milky Way from other people? How did people explain this band of light that they saw?
Oh, thank you for asking. My favorite comes from the Khoisan people of southern Africa. And they have a myth about the creation of the Milky Way that says at first there were no stars in the sky. It was just darkness. But there was this little girl who would have been a little black girl out dancing around a bonfire one night. And she's dancing, and then she gets tired, and she's hungry, as we all get after a night out. And she wants to go home, but she can't see how to get there. So she takes some embers from the fire and throws them up in the sky, and that becomes the path of the Milky Way that illuminates her way home. There are also all sorts of stories about how the Milky Way is used, because so many cultures imagine their gods living among the stars. And so there's this rift, a dark rift that passes through the light path of the Milky Way. And in Mayan folklore, that dark rift is the entrance to their underworld. And their sun god passes through that rift, goes to the underworld every day, and then comes back in the morning. And that's not only how they explain like the connection between the worlds of the living and the dead. It also explains how the day-night cycle happens, because their sun god is in the underworld at night.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, there are so many different connections that people have made with the night sky like that.
That's so cool. It's funny, we have so much research and we know so much more than we used to. At the same time, I have probably a much less personal relationship with the night sky, with the Milky Way, than people did 1,000 years ago.
Yeah, a big part of that is light pollution. The Dark Sky Association says now 80% of people have a diminished view of the night sky. So that's absolutely cutting off some forms of connection with space. But honestly, a lot of the ways that people connect today are through astrology, which is how people used to connect back in the day. But it was much more legit back in the day, I'll say. So the origin of astrology is paying attention to the motion of objects in the sky so that you could keep track of time. And so you could be reminded when certain annual activities were meant to happen again. For like timing your harvest, there were times when if a certain constellation appeared, that meant it was time to sow your fields. To the indigenous people of Australia, when their emu constellation appeared in the sky, that was when they knew the ground emus were laying their eggs, so they would go hunting for that. The Sirius star, when it appeared over Egypt, they were like, oh, the Nile River is about to flood, so let's prepare for that. It was timekeeping. It was navigation. But now we have phones and calendars and GPS. And we not only have lost view of the night sky, but we've lost the practical applications of the night sky because of technology. And that's usually a good thing. But I also feel like we've lost so much because we don't look up anymore.
Yeah. It still remains a revelatory experience.
Good.
I bought my son a little telescope, and we just took it in the backyard, and we looked at the moon, and you're like, holy sh**, the moon's a real place. Like, yes. You know what I mean? Like, it still remains, I think, a revelatory experience when people are able to really look.
Yeah, and you don't have to know anything about the science behind it either.
Yeah.
I've seen so many public observing nights where people take telescopes out on the streets of New York, and you show the, like, hardest-looking, grizzled old man a view of Saturn's rings through a telescope on a sidewalk, and he's going to be so, like, the childish delight that fills everyone's face when they realize, oh, you can actually see the rings? Oh, my God, you can see the big red spot on Jupiter when you can feel like Galileo seeing the moons of Jupiter for the first time. It's a transcendent experience, and it touches everyone.
Yeah. Well, Moya, it was like, what a joy to talk to you about all of this. It's such fun material, and you bring it to life in such a like incredibly rich way.
Thank you so much. Yeah, this has been great. You've asked some really great questions, and it's been a while since I've been able to voice the Milky Way like that. So thank you.
That was Dr. Moya McTeer. She is many things, but among them, she is a course instructor for Atlas Obscura, and we have a number of incredible astronomy and mythology of astronomy focused courses coming up. So check them out on atlasobscura.com. And this has all been part of In Over Our Heads Week, our astronomy and cosmic focused week of episodes. And we're doing it for a couple reasons. One, well, Dr. Moya McTeer is many things, but she's also a course instructor for Atlas Obscura. She has some just incredible courses about mythology and folklore and how it connects to astronomy. And she's just an incredible teacher. So you should go check those out on atlasobscura.com. But this is also all leading up to a particular cosmic event, the upcoming solar eclipse. The last one you can see in the U.S. for 20 years. And Atlas Obscura is throwing a big, big party. We are going to be in Hot Springs, Arkansas from April 5th to April 8th, celebrating with music and astronomers and storytellers like Moya McTeer, leading up to this moment when the moon perfectly blocks the sun because it is the perfect distance from the Earth in relative size to the sun that it exactly covers it and creates one of the greatest cosmic spectacles that's possible to see. So come and join us in Hot Springs, Arkansas, April 5th to April 8th. You can check that out on atlasobscura.com/eclipse. All right, I'll see you next time. This episode was produced by
Abby Peralt.
Our podcast is a co-production of Atlas Obscura and Stitcher Studios. The production team includes
Doug Baldinger,
Chris Naka,
Camille Stanley,
Johanna Mayer,
Baudelaire,
Gabby Gladney.
Our technical director is
Casey Holford.
And this episode was sound designed by
Manolo Morales
and mixed by
Luce Fleming.
And our theme and end credit music is by Sam Tyndall. I'm Dylan Thuris, wishing you all the wonder in the world. I will see you next time. The world isn't wide enough for those with an insatiable desire for discovery. The all-new 2024 Lincoln Nautilus Hybrid SUV offers the power and freedom to explore further and deeper than ever before. Intuitive, smart features ensure that you're always connected to the road ahead. Inside, a thoughtfully designed cabin immerses you in a universe that is all your own. The larger-than-life panoramic display spans the entire width of the cabin. It's customizable and interactive. Drivers can even personalize their backgrounds with a series of nature-inspired themes. This vehicle signals the arrival of an exciting new chapter for Lincoln. Discover more about the 2024 Lincoln Nautilus at Lincoln.com.
True or false? Walmart has eye care. True. Stop by Walmart to save and browse top designer frames right where you already shop. And they accept most insurance. Welcome to Easy Eye Care. Welcome to your Walmart.